Hi, my name is Jamie Ridgway, the head coach and owner of the Renaissance Academy of Martial Arts. And today I want to tell you about some of the programs that we offer at the Academy. So in our Little Dragons programs, our 4 to 6 year old class, that class is designed for, you know, teach kids focus. You know, at that age, it's very difficult for them to focus. So we want to teach them focus. We want to teach them basic tumbling, basic martial arts skills. At the same time, you know, stranger danger, what to do if there's somebody that comes along they don't know and how to act. So we go over all those things, kind of a prep program for kids. We teach a lot of jiu-jitsu in there too. The 7 to 12 year old kids, now they're a little more mature and they're ready to start taking a big piece of the information as far as like martial arts classes. So in that class, we teach them Taekwondo blended with Muay Thai kickboxing, blended with Gracie jiu-jitsu, so that they are well-rounded. They can kick, punch, clinch, and grapple. And that's where, you know, in today's world, we see a lot of self-defense situations end up, is on the ground. So they need to know that too. So when they come out with a junior black belt, not only are they focused, but they're also well-rounded as a martial artist. And you're gonna see things like respect and self-discipline at home through the program, because that's the most important thing that we're teaching the kids. And that is, hey, we don't want them to learn all these skills and not showing respect and saying yes ma'am and no ma'am and doing their chores at home. That's really what it's all about.
What's up, guys? It's Obey. Welcome back to another episode of The Podacy. I am once again just privileged, honored to have finished a great Thanksgiving with family, and I'm so excited to have an opportunity to sit down with the police chief of Lynchburg. I almost said Liberty of Lynchburg City, Police Chief Zunima. Thank you so much for being here. This is just an honor and a privilege. Seriously, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor to be here. I appreciate it.
Man, I'm so excited. So I just want to jump right in, but before we get into like the meat and potatoes of our conversation, I think a lot of people who maybe have seen you around town and they're like, that dude has a weird mustache on.
Well, I'm glad you brought it up. Yeah, so you'll only see this on my face for 1 month of the year. Some men like yourself can carry a mustache pretty good. I do not carry one very well, but I'm a part of a group called Mustaches for Kids, about 150 or so of us people here in the community. This is the 6th year we've done it, and we, from November 6th this year through December 6th, will be raising money through growing our mustaches, kind of a silly way, but last year we raised about $170,000 here in the community that went to six different organizations, nonprofits, that support children's activities like Jubilee, Boys and Girls Club, Big Brothers Big Sisters, and several others. So we're hoping to get close to $200,000 this year. So we've got 4 days left, and we're doing a great job with it. And that's why we all look like fools when you see us around town with these big caterpillars on our upper lips.
So. I mean, those are some expensive mustaches. I'm just like, Is it just the mustache? Do you guys do tricks with your mustache? Like, what brings in all this money with the mustaches?
Yeah, so it's, I think people pity us, quite honestly, for having to go around in public like this. And we just ask for their mercy, and they're kind enough to donate money towards these great causes that we support.
Man, and then along with you know, being a part of the community and supporting the community and doing greater, you know, things like this, you're the police chief. Can you tell, just really quick before we dive right in, can you tell the people a little bit about just like you, Police Chief Zunima? Like, I don't think a lot of people know the person behind the name. They know, right, we have a police chief.
Right.
They may know his last name starts with a Z, but they're like, Zunima, is he like European? Is he, right, where is he from? Is that a Lynchburg name? Can you, right, give us a little bit more about yourself?
Yeah, sure. So I was born and raised in Western New York, outside, okay, of Buffalo. I tell people I grew up and stayed living there until I got old enough till I realized I didn't have to anymore. It was very cold and long, long winters. And the area I lived in was about 45 minutes outside of Buffalo, a very rural area, agricultural area. There was literally more cows in the community in the county I lived in than there were people. So real big dairy farming,
wow,
area. Went to school there. I was involved in sports throughout high school, and really enjoyed kind of the team concept of being involved in things like that. And then went on to my undergrad in SUNY Brockport, which is right outside of Rochester, New York. Same,
nice,
kind of general area.
So SUNY is a City University of New York, right?
Actually. So State University of New York.
Sorry.
There is a CUNY, which is down in the city. Yeah, okay. But there's a bunch of different ones throughout the state. It's their state, New York State college system. So
nice.
Went there, studied criminal justice there. Originally went there thinking I was going to be a stockbroker. And then took a first few math classes and realized this wasn't going to cut it, and kind of changed what I was doing. I had a brother who's about 3 years older than me. He was a deputy sheriff up there in Western New York. His wife was from up there as well. She went to the University of Lynchburg, then Lynchburg College here, mm-hmm. liked the area, wanted to stay, convinced him to move down, and I followed about 3 years afterwards. So
wow.
I've been here since, moved here the end of 96, started at the PD in January 2nd of 97. So I've been here ever since. Married for all those years that since I moved here, since 97, with a nice young lady who was kind enough to follow me down here. And
awesome.
I've got two boys that are 17 and 14. So some of the gray you see in the side of my head comes from my two teenagers. But they're good boys. They do really well. And
nice.
They keep me straight, no doubt about it.
I think one of your kids go to the same gym with me, with Ram, right?
Yep. Yeah, one of them does martial arts and has been doing that for several years. So
yes.
Absolutely.
It's an amazing discipline. And Coach Jamie, he was on the podcast, I think it's episode 6. He does a great job there.
Oh, absolutely.
And that place just really helps, I think, kids, adults, really hone in on a lot of really good life lessons and disciplines for sure.
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
So we met at Citizens Academy, and it was a great time. I know I've talked about it on the podcast a lot, just like what Citizens Academy meant for me and
right.
what, you know, the benefits of doing Citizens Academy. And also we have a police academy here
right.
in the city of Lynchburg. And so I encourage everyone to do it. And I remember just like really seeing you and your officers engage with the community. And what I've learned with doing this podcast and just in my own personal life is that there's so much fruit from the messiness of conversations. And we need to be okay with that. We need to be okay with stepping in and having these conversations.
Right.
And so I was surprised that you were there and high-ranking officers. I thought, you know, doing Citizens Academy, it would have just been like two dudes, you know, low-level cops, you know, young guys who were just forced to be there. And I thought I just want to commend you and your staff for actually showing up. Y'all answered questions to the ability that you were able to,
right.
and y'all were honest. And I think it really showed me a little bit about your character. And I said, yo, I would love one day to do a podcast with you and just kind of dive in a little bit more. Because, I mean, the heart of this podcast is that we want to build dialogue within communities
right.
around the world. So our hope is that people would see me sit down with people from all different walks, different backgrounds, and we would engage in conversations, and we would see that, oh, what Obey is doing on this podcast, I can do in my community.
Right.
Who's my police chief? Who's my mayor? Who right. are the people in my community? And so I'm excited. Like this is a manifestation of just like a lot of dreams and prayers. And so I think for me, like podcasts like this are so important for people to really see what's possible out there for themselves in their communities, you know? Because I think you can tweet, you can put on Facebook your opinions, but having this kind of conversation
right.
is not easy. And I'm glad that you stepped into it.
No, I appreciate you having me. I think it's critical for, I think, our community members to see not just me as the police chief, but our officers as human beings, because it's so easy to just look at them as the badge and the position of authority. But, you know, our men and women, they put their pants on the same way you do, one leg at a time, mm. and they have families, and they have the same concerns and challenges in their lives that many of our citizens do. So anytime we can do something like this, I think it's good.
Yeah, so I was listening to a podcast with Joe Rogan and Malcolm Gladwell, and it's a fantastic podcast. If you guys get a chance to check out Joe Rogan's podcast, it's one of the early ones, or the ones he just put out, and they got into a conversation about Malcolm Gladwell's new book, and it's called Talking with Strangers, I believe. And the concept of the book is that we in this kind of generation right now, where we are the most connected than we've ever been in history, still feels very siloed. And he talks about a lot of different situations throughout history where if people were able just to converse and get to know each other, like you said, like, hey, a police officer is a human being with challenges, with things going on in their lives. And they come to that with work just like you do. Right. And they have a high stress, you know, position, high stress job. And so they were talking about, you know, a lot of different cases and I was prepping for this podcast, it was really entertaining to me, just like the conversation they were having. And I was thinking about meeting with you and talking through, you know, right, your role here with Lynchburg City. So looking at first and foremost, like police community relations, like how, looking national to local, because one of the big things for me is like we focus so much on national.
Right.
So we'll talk a little bit about national stuff, but like I really want to focus more on the local. But looking national to local, how do you feel like police to community relations is right now? So you can start national, then you can go state, then you can go Lynchburg City. Like, how do you feel about that?
I'll start bigger and maybe go smaller. Yeah. You know, I think there's been a proliferation over the last several years of a lot of negative media towards law enforcement. Mm-hmm. I will tell you that some of that is warranted. I'm not going to sit here and tell you that, you know, we are perfect. You know, there are bad cops, just like there are bad doctors, bad lawyers, bad priests, bad teachers, you name it. You know, when you have as many folks as we have in this type of profession, you're going to occasionally, unfortunately, get some that slips through the cracks, right? And obviously, locally, when we identify those, we do everything we can to make sure those folks aren't representing our organization. Mm-hmm. I tell people this all the time, but, you know, the only people out there that despise bad cops more than the public are the good cops. Because the last thing we want is one bad apple spoiling the bunch, so to speak. So, you know, on a national level, I think we've seen a lot of unfortunate media coverage of law enforcement. Again, some is poor choices made by individual officers, but we're in a profession that it gets painted with a very, very broad brush.
Yeah.
You know, if you think back to different times in our era, you know, a little bit probably before your time, but, you know, Rodney King in Los Angeles, if you know anything about that scenario,
yes.
Here are officers literally on the opposite coast from where we're at. And I can remember coming on the job and seeing things here in our community where people are making comments to me and to other officers about actions police officers took thousands of miles away. So it's a unique profession in that, you know, one person making a poor choice in California can impact how we're able to do law enforcement here in Virginia. So it's challenging there. And I think that, you know, we've got to make sure, you know, my ask of people, quite honestly, is to try and sort through what you see in the media, because you can find everything from the far right to the far left and everything in between. And I just want people to use your own judgment, sort through and filter through and get to the bottom and develop your own opinion. Don't let somebody else tell you what your opinion should be on a topic. I mean, especially when you take that and you kind of shrink it down to the local level.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that I'm really, really proud of with our organization, and our men and women go out of their way to engage our community here and to really partner with so many different organizations in the community, from, you know, civic groups to nonprofit groups to our schools to businesses and everything in between, in hopes that my goal is that our community members know our officers not by Officer Zudema, but they can come up to me and say, "Hey, Ryan, how are you doing?" And our officers can do that likewise. And again, that's part of that humanizing our officers, making sure that people recognize our officers are out there doing, certainly, as you said, a very difficult job, but at the same time, they're members of this community too. And, you know, I think locally, overall, I think we have a very good relationship with our community. Now, I'm not naive enough to think there aren't segments of our community that we don't struggle with sometimes. And that's where we try and spend more time and more of our efforts to build those bridges and make sure folks realize that, you know, we are your police department, not the police department. There's a big difference there. You know, we are your partners and your protectors. And the only way that works is if we are collaborating with all those different people I spoke about.
Okay, so look, I want to unpack a couple of things. So one thing is, so you've looked at some of the national cases and you were like, man, these, like, you know, you pointed out the Rodney King case, a tragic case of, you know, I think a little bit of overaggression by police officers. I want to ask you, so when you hear something in the news or you see a national case, for just protocol with you guys as officers, does that affect how you guys police? So, like, when, you know, I went really deep into the Amber Geiger case and, you know, called a friend who was a lawyer and just really, like, wanted to see it from all different perspectives, right?
Right.
Because, you know, I understand that, like, you guys come home from 8 hours and I know friends on the force. I've never been shot at. I've only held a gun in a gun range. I don't know what it's like for my day-to-day job is to protect people, to put my life on the line and to come home. And then, you know, I may have thought I saw something and I escalate myself to this place. So when I think of someone like that or these situations where maybe someone just wasn't aware of their community, wasn't aware of their neighbors as well, wasn't as involved, they heightened their senses because of their day job. Do you guys ever take those cases and, you know, hey, guys, like, you know, we're going to do some training on this, or is there a case that you can point out, like point to and be like, hey, we felt like this was a cop that made some mistakes. Here's how we said, okay, we're going to take this and apply this to our police department and grow.
Right. So, you know, this job is very unique, as you said, and, you know, I'll never try a Monday morning quarterback a decision that an officer made that he or she has to make in an instantaneous moment in time with usually very limited information to make that decision based upon that very well could mean the difference between life and death for that officer or other people that are involved. So I won't second guess that. But at the same time, we do absolutely look at situations like that and say, okay, if that were to happen here, do we have first and foremost a policy and the training in place to adequately cover that? Are our officers trained to deal with a situation like that? If they are trained, are they equipped properly to deal with a situation like that? Mm-hmm. And then do we have policy in place that covers that? That guides everything we do as a police department, our policy does. And so we try and look at those things through that lens, I think, in a lot of cases to see, okay, should that happen here, are we prepared? Not a specific case of necessarily officers acting bad, but certainly one that drew a lot of attention is Charlottesville, right? So you know, the situation in Charlottesville, absolutely. When that took place, we were sitting there saying, okay, if something like that were to happen here, do we have the training? Do we have the equipment? Do we have things in place to address and deal with that? And one of the things we recognize in that situation is some of our local ordinances or our laws were not up to where they needed to be. So we worked with the city attorney, we worked with city council, and ultimately we updated some of our laws to make things that you would think are common sense in today's day and age, but you know, sometimes we don't always make sure governing bodies don't always make sure the laws are right where they need to be unless there's a crisis sometimes. And so we looked at that in conjunction with city council and city attorney and took things like, you can't come to some type of a public demonstration with an open flame. You can't do that, right? Obviously, you know, that is something that seems pretty common sense, but right. Prior to that ordinance being adopted about 2 years ago, I should say, updated about 2 years ago, you could have done that here without being in violation of the law. And other things like you can't bring bats and clubs and shields and helmets and that kind of stuff.
I love that. You guys started to look and be like, this probably isn't good for peaceful protests.
Right. Wait,
you're like, we're peaceful protesting. Right. I'm just holding the bat, officer.
And that's it. Right. And, you know, the reality in those situations are, is, you know, our job as officers of the law, we're sworn to uphold the Constitution. That means First Amendment is a part of that. So we absolutely support people coming out and peacefully protesting. There is, though, very much a difference between a protest and a riot. And that's what we were trying to convey with some of those ordinances being updated, is that, look, we'll support you. We will protect you to come out here and make sure you can peacefully protest and express your opinion on these topics. But we're not going to have you coming, you know, geared up, ready to go to war, basically. We need you to be there abiding by the local laws and the state laws to make sure you don't have implements or objects like open flames and bats and clubs and things like that where you could harm somebody with.
So it looks like you guys are starting to see certain things ahead of time and starting to strategize. Can you talk about, like, okay, so you're reading certain things like, hey, these people are saying it's a peaceful protest, but I'm seeing tiki torches. They're all looking the same. Some of them have clubs. This is not looking like it's here for peace.
Right.
So can you talk to, like, how, as police officers, this is one of the things I've always tried to understand. Like, y'all are always reading people, and it's a tough job because you're trying to protect people. So to protect people, you have to start to read the crowd and see who's a potential for danger, who's not. And sometimes that warns that you make a mistake, right? So, like, for you guys, you know, we all, like, as much as the media tries to show one way, there's also a ton of videos of you guys just walking up peacefully to a car and a guy just loads a clip on you. And I imagine, I've seen one where a police officer legitimately is putting his body on the line and this guy's trying to speed off. And I'm like, man, I can't even think of the psyche of that man when he leaves. And he has to remember, like, that was just this race of guy, one time, individual person. I'm not going to use that to apply to someone else. So when you look at, as you guys train and, you know, from your perspective as a cop, how do you guys do that? Like, how does that work? Because, like, that's got to be hard. Like, how do I look at a guy who maybe he's a little bit more rough looking and not assume that, like, oh, this dude's definitely in a gang, let me pull this dude over.
Right.
Or read body language, you know. I want to kind of get the conversation into this discussion I want to have about aggression versus de-escalation. Because I think for you guys, that's where the rubber meets the road. It's like, how do I address situations? Like you said, like, from 1 second, it could escalate. So that's why you guys were like, listen, you guys can peaceful protest, but you're not bringing these items because we know if it escalates, then it becomes a riot. We never achieved anything. So we're right. looking ahead. So how do you guys read that? How do you guys train your officers? What is that like for you guys? Is that difficult?
It's extremely difficult. Yeah. I mean, you know, we're a profession that is often judged by folks with limited exposure or limited experience in our profession. And we are often, if not always, second guessed on whatever we do. And we recognize that's a part of the job, certainly. But, you know, part of it is we need to focus on actions. You know, we don't necessarily, there are times where appearance plays in, like if the 7-Eleven is robbed and someone says it was a white male with a mullet wearing an AC/DC t-shirt running down the street, then absolutely we're going to take race and appearance into account because it's a part of a description of the suspect.
So when you stop somebody who's white with a mullet and AC/DC shirt, he needs to understand it ain't about you. I'm just trying to find how many dudes fit this description at this time of night. Right now, yeah. And I got to stop everybody.
2 blocks away from the, from the 7-Eleven, gotcha. Right? So that's part of it, right, is we look at actions. And, you know, there's a lot of work that goes in. If you're taking the analogy back to, let's say, protests, right, there's a lot of work that goes in ahead of time. Weeks and weeks, sometimes months, if it's a planned protest, where we will go and do a lot of research. We will reach out to communities. If Group X we know is coming to Lynchburg, we'll find out where has Group X been before. We'll reach out to those police departments or sheriff's offices and say, okay, what did you see with this group? What types of problems did you have? Were they peaceful? How did they organize? How did they assemble? What did they, you know, kind of, what was their MO for, or modus operandi for their actions there? And so we'll try and, again, learn from where they've been before. And then one of the things we do that, it, again, seems like common sense, but assuming the group is willing, if Obey is the leader of Group X that's coming to Lynchburg to protest something, we're going to call Obey and say, hey, we'd love to sit down and talk to you. Make sure that Obey understands, okay, here's what the laws are in our community. Mm-hmm. We're going to do everything within our power to keep you and your group safe. Mm-hmm. But here's also what our expectations of you are. Mm-hmm. Now, I can't force you to do certain things, right? But I can tell you that this is kind of where we draw the line when it comes to stepping over those laws that are in place and what you can expect from us, right? Because the challenge we get a lot of times when we deal with especially protests is it's not just the group that comes to protest. It's counter-protest groups and then counter-counter-protest groups. And sometimes it's difficult to know who's in whose side and who's against who. And so the more intelligence we can gather, and a lot of times that's just reaching out to the group organizers to say, hey, what are you doing? What are you bringing with you? You know, what do you expect? How long are you going to be there? Again, they don't have to tell us any of that stuff, but we are doing that in an effort to try and protect them and keep them safe while they exercise their First Amendments. On the training side, a little more generally away from, you know, talking specifically about protests, we train all of our folks in what we call fair and impartial policing. Fair and impartial policing looks at a lot of different things, but one of the things it focuses on a lot is implicit biases, right? We all have implicit biases. You do, I do. Everybody has an implicit bias. That's based on how we were raised, where we were raised, how we were brought up, who we socialized with, how we interacted. And I taught this course for several years in our department along with many other folks. And the example I always gave was, you know, I grew up, I told you, in Western New York, pretty rural area. So from the time my parents were about 5 till I was about 15, they owned a mom and pop general store, grocery store. They sold groceries, they sold, you could do subs there, you could buy hardware there, you could do a little bit of everything, right? Tiny little rural community. So big agricultural area. Back then, before automation, a lot of machinery, in the summer months when the fields were ready to be taken up, they'd bring in a lot of migrant workers. The overwhelming majority of migrant workers that came to this community that I lived in as a young kid were either Hispanic or African American. And they would come to our store usually around lunchtime to eat. They'd get, you know, subs or whatever food they'd get. They'd come in an old school bus. I remember this like it was yesterday. They'd pull up in an old school bus, and I remember my father yelling to my brother and I, as probably as young as I was 7 years old, get up front right now. We come running up front. Okay, Dad, what's going on? He says, okay, migrant workers are here. I'm letting 3 in at a time. You follow them around everywhere they go so they don't steal stuff. So as a young kid, what seed does that plant in my mind? Right? That seed that plants in my mind is if you're African-American or if you're Hispanic, you're a thief, right? I know that's not the case, but as a young kid, you don't know any better, right? So that could be an implicit bias for me if I were not to recognize that, and that could be a problem, right? So it's based on how you're born, how you're raised, you know, where you grow up and how you're socialized, right? So getting into this job, when I start talking to folks and teaching this class on fair and impartial policing, we've got to recognize that just because someone to me is African American or Hispanic, when I deal with them, I know they're not a thief. But I also know when I was 8 years old that that was what was implied to me, right? So we teach folks that implicit biases are really important to recognize, so that when we're taking action, especially as law enforcement officers, we cannot let that come into that. Now, again, that was my upbringing, but I don't allow that to impact how I do police work, right? And do I believe that Hispanics and African Americans are all thieves? Absolutely not, right? Mm-hmm. But at that age, at a very young age, that's what was taught to me. So that's a big part. The other part we teach folks in there is process versus outcome. And a big part of the process versus outcome piece is they did study after study, and it has shown repeatedly, no matter what groups they use or how many or what age, that how we treat people as law enforcement officers is much more important than the outcome of that interaction. So the study they did showed that folks who are stopped for a traffic offense, who are treated poorly but did not get a ticket, versus folks who were stopped for a traffic offense, were treated really well, right, but got a ticket, the folks that got the ticket were so much more happier with that interaction than the folks that didn't get the ticket. Now, logically, on the surface, that doesn't make any sense, right? Because nobody wants to get a ticket, right? It's money, you gotta go to court, your insurance goes up, all that stuff that comes along with that, right? But it proves that how we treat people and how we talk to people is way more important than the outcome. Now, we're gonna treat people, I hope, with absolutely the most respect they allow us to treat them with, okay? And some people aren't going to allow us to do that, but that's fine. We still need to treat them exactly how I would like my mother treated, or my brother, or my father, or my grandparent, or whoever it may be. So that process versus outcome is really important. So that's some of the training we provide our folks to make sure that they're focusing on the right things as they interact with our community members.
So when you're looking at different situations, you know, different people, different backgrounds, different cultures, one of the things I thought was profound from that podcast I was listening to with Malcolm Gladwell and Joe Rogan was that he was explaining the point of how the police officer, when he was interacting with Sandra Bland, did not know her culture, her background, and was not able to relate to her because they were strangers. And one of the things I was thinking about is, like, you know, whenever I meet a police officer, depending on where it's at, we're complete strangers to each other. He doesn't know me. He doesn't know what I'm about. He doesn't know my character, doesn't know anything about me. And so that's a really unique thing, in that small microcosm of that communication. You know, this police officer is trying to do his job and get home safe.
Right.
And I'm trying to get out of a ticket and get home safe.
Right.
And so I'm being honest, you know.
Oh, I get it.
And so when I've had certain instances with police officers where, you know, they've had a partner come from one side with hand on the pistol, just like, what's going on? Because of, you know, maybe my speed or the time of night or different right. things. And it makes me feel a certain way, or the tone when right. they come up scares me, or I'm nervous, or I've had situations where, I'll tell you of one on the topic of aggression versus de-escalation, where I was in high school and I was being dumb, and we were coming back from hanging out, and outside of Atlanta, this really awesome highway called 85. And we decided 85 leads into 29, or not 29, I'm thinking of Virginia, 20 Buford Highway, which runs right past the Mall of Georgia, which is in Gwinnett County. And there's a super long strip, runs right past the Gwinnett Braves Stadium, which is a AAA baseball team for the Atlanta Braves. And if you catch it at the right time, especially in high school, you can go really, really fast. And right. it feels like you're in Fast Five. So my friends were in the car, you know. My brother was in the car. My friend Heather and her friend were in the other car. And they decided, like, we're going to race. And this is, I'm just being honest, Chief Zitterman, this is, you know, this is not wise, right? You would not say right. we should do this.
Right.
She starts racing and I start racing, and of course I'm not gonna lose in my 98 Toyota Corolla. So I push my foot down, and everything she had, boom, I mean 75, 85, 95. And as we're passing the Quick Trip, I just see the police officer just like, almost like this idiot, and just goes zoom. And I stop, and Heather just keeps going. And then I picked back up, and I thought, well, I'm going to act like I didn't do nothing. So I'm just chilling in the right lane, like, I wonder if he saw me. And of course, this dude comes speeding down, pulls up behind me. Now, in this unique situation, I was in the wrong. I'm going 95 in a 65.
Right.
I was, I think at the time, 17 years old. Just got my license. I was not supposed to be speeding. So he pulls over this old car. It does smell because it's old and the upholstery's old. And the officer comes up to my side, and another officer comes to the passenger side. They are very aggressive. Put your hands on the steering wheel. Do not move. I'm getting a little geeked. I'm like, yo, this is one of my first few interactions with police officers. So I was like, yo, my bad. I wasn't listening.
Right.
So I'm like trying to talk to him. He's like, and he's yelling at me. I'm like, yo, man, watch your attitude. I'm just trying to talk to you. So then they ask us to step outside the car, and they're like, probably now there are things they're looking at, and they're like, what's going on here? I've heard the term go beyond the badge. You know, when you pull someone over, looking at other things, maybe there's something else going on here. So then with that situation, they decided to cuff us and to cool us off. One of the things that I am just, I'm a very big Papa Bear protector. And so I did not like how one of the officers, when they were putting us in handcuffs, you know, addressed or put them on my brother. It's a little aggressive. I was like, hey, watch how you touch my brother. Now, I do not understand the aggression level, right? I'm a young kid. And so, thank God, these two officers began to realize, because at that moment, I had escalated. I was getting upset now.
Right.
Now I'm pulled over. I'm on the side of the street. I don't know what's going on. It's late at night. Yo, we're not doing anything like stupid. Like, we're just like, I messed up. I'm sorry. I'll give you my license, yo. Like, but like, don't do that to my brother. He's,
right.
You know, he's 14. Like, don't put him on. Like, you know what I'm saying? They're asking, doing the Miranda rights. They're checking our bodies. They're asking, is there any paraphernalia, any drugs? And things are just escalating. And in my mind, I'm just getting escalated to a place. But we don't know each other.
Right.
And so I thought back to that situation, and I was like, man, imagine if that police officer was just on a bad day, or who knows what.
Right.
And then he had met my, because I don't know how, and I'll let you address this in a second, but like, how you're to address that, right? Because as I'm elevating my aggression, I'm not realizing that he's going to have to match that, because he's the authority figure in this situation. Right. And I have to calm down.
Right.
So as they put me over to the side, they call my parents, they, you know, do all the stuff. I just think back to the situation. I was like, man, that dude calmed himself down, calmed his homeboy. They went and had a conversation and just came back with a different tone, dressed everything, rose right. for a ticket. My dad came with me. I was in really big trouble. I think the judge was kind enough to, I think it was like lower the sentence or something like that.
Right.
But I just think back to that situation. I was like, man, what could have happened?
Right.
You know, because the cop didn't just look and like, black kid driving, this is it. This right. is my chance.
Right.
You know, I escalated things and I put him in a situation. So like, what can you walk me through? What was he thinking? What were some things that he's seen, you know, in that situation? And then, you know, the aggression versus de-escalation, like, is he allowed to just like escalate that? And like, what are the do's and don'ts? Like, can you walk me through that?
Yeah. So obviously, without knowing all the details right, and right. seeing what he saw that day, I can't speak specifically to your case,
right,
but
right.
in generalities, you know, right. The challenge for officers, you know, in that situation, you know, they see a vehicle obviously speeding by at a high rate of speed, probably see both of them, I would imagine, more than likely, don't know what's going on. They stop you, you know, one of the most dangerous things our officers do every day is vehicle stops for a lot of reasons. Some are run over while they're standing by a driver's door on the side of the road and hit by other vehicles. Wow. They don't know, like you said, you know, you've seen videos where officers walk up to a car and before they can even say anything, somebody could potentially shoot at them. So they don't know what to expect in that car. That could be, you could be driving that fast because you have your wife in the passenger seat and she's in labor and you're taking her to the hospital, or you could be driving that fast because you just shot and killed somebody, you know, back in, you know, the town before and you're trying to get away. They don't know, or anything in between, or you could just be a young teenage kid who's driving too fast, right? And you don't know any better at the time. They just don't know really what to expect when they're going up there. So, you know, when they approach a car, they're trying to assess that situation first and foremost. They're trying to see everything that's going on in that car, trying to see how many people there are in that car. One of the first things that we always want to see when we're dealing with a situation where there's a lot of unknowns is where people's hands are, right? Because that's what hurt us. You know, your hands are what are used for various implements, whether it be a knife, a gun, a bat, fill in the blank, to harm folks, right? So if we can control where your hands are, that will help us feel a little more comfortable with the situation right out of the gate.
So that's why when he came to the car, first thing was, and so when I wasn't doing that, it is like imperative
absolutely
in that situation that he sees my hands.
You could be reaching for your license, but he doesn't know that, right? He or she might think you're reaching for a weapon. So obviously they want to control hands first, get them up there. You know, our folks are taught de-escalation techniques to try and, you know, one of the things that when feasible, assuming they're not being shot at or there's not something crazy going on, when they approach a car, our policy is when they walk up to the car, what they should be saying is, you know, good afternoon, good morning, good evening, whatever. You know, I'm Officer Zudem with the Lynchburg Police Department. The reason I stopped you, sir or ma'am, is because you were speeding, you know, 95 and a 65. That usually helps kind of set the tone a little bit. It tells you first and foremost who I am, right? And secondly, it tells you why I have you stopped, right? And then the last thing that they should ask is there any reason why, you know, you're behaving in this manner? Because again, you might have your pregnant wife in the passenger seat and you're trying to get to the hospital, right? Because she's in labor. But the idea of that is like, okay, we're going to kind of break the ice, so to speak, and say, hey, here's who I am, here's why I stopped you, and here's what's going on, right? A lot of times we find that gives, because a lot of times, not necessarily in your scenario you provided, but people may not know why they're getting stopped. They may not realize that there was a stop sign they ran back there. They may not realize that they couldn't turn left at that intersection or fill in the blank. So a lot of times people are on edge because they're just like, okay, what's going on? Why am I stopped, right? So if we can kind of take that away right at the beginning, hopefully that helps immediately de-escalate that a little bit. And then, as you said, you know, they're trying to assess the situation. At one point, they probably realize, look, this is just a 17, 16-year-old kid with his 14-year-old brother who's out driving too fast, hot rodding, and that's about all we got. Then they can let their guard down a little bit, right? And that's probably what happened in that situation. They were able to come back and maybe approach in a little less confrontational manner. Because ideally, we don't want our traffic stops to be confrontational, right? We want our traffic stops to it's a part of doing business. Nobody likes getting stopped by the police, right? But it's a part of what we do. And we do that because we want to keep the roadway safe, right? Ideally, we want to change behavior. We don't write tickets so that we can get more money. We don't write tickets so that your insurance can go up. We write tickets to help change behavior so that the 16-year-old Obey is not 2 years later driving 95 miles an hour down the expressway in Lynchburg, right? I would imagine after that, you probably weren't driving 95 after that anymore, right?
Was not.
It's the goal is to change behavior. But, you know, we want to make sure our officers are treating folks, again, with the utmost respect they possibly can. Because a lot of folks, a lot of times, you know, some of the folks that we deal with, throw aside traffic stops, you know, we deal with, the way it was described to me early in my career, this is one of the only professions, if you look at society as kind of a high-rise building, right, let's say a 20-story building with, you know, the first level being the poorest of the poor, the penthouse being the richest of the rich, and everything in between. This profession is one of the few that gets off the elevator on every floor, right? Our folks deal with everybody from all walks of life in society, and some of the folks we deal with don't have a lot, right? And the only thing that some of these folks have is respect. And if you take that respect away from them, that's when we run into a lot of problems, right? You know, you'll hear folks a lot of times, don't disrespect me, man, especially if you're doing it in front of their friends or their family, right? Because if I don't have a car, I don't have a house, I don't have any worldly possessions, all I've got is my dignity. If we take that away from you as a police officer, that's where we get ourselves into trouble. And that's where people don't mind saying, you know what, I got nothing to lose. I don't mind fighting a police officer. I don't mind going to jail for this or that, you know? So we want to treat people with as much respect as we can and try and give them an opportunity to explain why they're doing what they're doing, right? It doesn't mean they might still not get a ticket or might still not get arrested, but at least give them the respect to explain what's going on and give them an opportunity to do that.
Now, you were talking at one point that I think is really important when I think about like police officers in the community. And when we look at, you know, addressing someone who respect is all they have, it's culture. You know, so in that culture, that's the currency that that person has. Absolutely. And so if you take that away, you know, you take everything away from that person. So as you guys look at, like, you know, community aspects, race, and different, you know, lower income areas, where as the lower the income goes, the more the need for respect, dignity is important.
Absolutely.
So for you guys, how do you think that, like, for police officers, you know, do you think you guys play a part in racial reconciliation? Do you feel like, you know, for police officers, as they look towards the future and look at the ever changing cultures and neighborhoods? I mean, Lynchburg in 96, when you got here, looks way different than now.
Absolutely.
So as you look to that, how do you help someone who's 23, who, you know, is a young woman on the police force, who grew up in a rural area, doesn't know many black people, doesn't understand black culture,
right,
and may see something as disrespect, or may see and obey and be like, nah, something's up.
Right.
And escalate something to where it doesn't need to. How do you guys teach? Like, that's got to be tough. You know?
It's very difficult, right? Because, you know, I didn't grow up as an African-American, much like you didn't grow up as a Caucasian. So, yeah. You know, for me to say, oh, I know what you dealt with, or I know what you're going through, that would be a complete lie, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, as much exposure as we can get folks to that is important, which is part of why we partner with so many different organizations in this community. You know, we partner a lot with a group called One Community, One Voice, mm-hmm. Pastor James Cam, and we go out into a lot of the neighborhoods you're talking about and try and work with those communities to, one, help them resolve challenges and issues they have. But in doing that, we're building relationships, right? Folks are getting to know these officers on a one-on-one basis and getting to understand, you know, I'll never forget early on in my career, right? So when we went to the police academy 20 plus years ago, right, you were always told when somebody asks you your name, you tell them your name is Officer Zudema. And when they ask you what your first name is, you tell them it's Officer, right? Well, I mean, that immediately sets up a confrontational exchange, right?
Mm.
If you ask me that. So we try and tell our officers now, like, look, it's no secret what your first name is, okay? You know, that you can put that out there. It's okay. And, you know, helping build those relationships in that way is really, really important, and being in those communities. And, you know, as a young officer, I remember dealing with arresting a young man. And I say young man, he was probably 22, 23 years old, so an adult.
Mm-hmm.
And his mother or his grandmother would show up, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they would want to know, and this is an African American, right? They would want to know, what's he being arrested for? Well, a lot of officers would immediately say, he's an adult, I don't need to tell you anything. But again, understanding that culture, it doesn't matter if that kid's 66 years old, that's still their baby, right? And you better tell them what's going on with their baby.
That's right.
Because if you don't, that's going to create, again, more confrontation there.
That's
so
right.
Understanding that, the only way to really do that is to be exposed to it. So however we can engage our community on different levels, we're trying to do that everywhere we can. As far as racial reconciliation, you know, I think our role in that is first and foremost recognizing what this profession did in the 60s and 70s, right?
Mm.
You know, there was some things that were done across this country by people wearing badges of authority that were not right. Just that simple.
That's
you've
right.
got to recognize that first and foremost, okay? And then the second part is you've got to realize in Lynchburg, Virginia, that there are people alive right now that lived through that here in this community and
That's
in other
right.
communities, right?
That's right.
So for them not to immediately trust me when I say, hey, I'm Ryan Zudem, I'm your police chief, trust everything I say, I've got to recognize there's a reason why they might not trust that. And then I also have to recognize is that when they went through those experiences, they didn't just take that and bottle it up and just say, okay, that happened. They told their kids, they've told their grandkids. So now we have two, maybe three generations or more in some cases who have a image and an understanding of what the police are based on their grandparents or parents' experience back in the 60s, right? So we've got to work extra hard to help disprove that.
Mm-hmm.
We've got to show them that, look, no, that, yes, that happened back then. That was not appropriate, but that is not who we are, what we do now as a law enforcement agency. And, you know, words are great, but actions speak a whole lot more than them. So that's what I think our role is in that sense, is making sure we don't repeat those mistakes and making sure we recognize that we have a role in helping educate several generations on where this profession has come from, you know, five, almost six decades ago now.
So when you're looking at, you know, which I thought that was just eloquent how you broke that down and how you said, you know, racial reconciliation, here's how we have to our part to play, here's the things that we got to do. Do you feel like for those communities that have been hurt by the police department and feel like, yeah, I got you, Chief Zudema, Do you feel like you have to have, you know, more diversity on the police force for them to be able to feel like what are the steps that you as a police chief, because, all right, listen, we throughout the U.S. I've heard a lot of good things, but I've not seen a lot of action put behind. There's a lot of politicians, and for, you know, not to disrespect you in any way, but for, you know, some of your job is politics, you know, you know, you have to make people feel safe and make sure they feel happy.
Right.
But they will always remember Police Chief Zunima by his actions.
Right.
And so for you, Police Chief Zunima, as you look at your legacy, like, and you're telling this community, trust me, this time it's different.
Right.
What are the steps that you're taking to say Lynchburg is about racial reconciliation, or Lynchburg is about, you know, growing a more open and communicative community that loves each other, that talks through things, even if it's a little bit mucky. We're family. So I mean, sometimes someone's going to get heated, someone's going to get passionate, someone's still going to hold on to a past hurt because it still needs to be addressed.
Right.
What are some actions you're taking to address those things?
So a couple of things, kind of two parts to this. So the first part is what we've recognized is that, you know, me walking into an African-American community as a white guy and saying, hey, I'm your police chief, trust me, that by itself is not going to work, just plain and simple. You know, over many, many, many years of that and actions, that will help that. But what we've recognized in Lynchburg especially is, you know, we are a city of so many churches, right? And the African-American community is very, very vested in their churches, very vested in their churches.
I think we're the most church city per capita, or something like one of the most church cities per capita.
Wouldn't surprise me, yeah. And so what we've tried to do is reach out to our faith-based leaders in this community, in the African-American community specifically, and start to build those bridges there. And so if people can see that their pastor is starting to trust the police and the police chief and police officers, hopefully over some time they will see that. And so one of the things we've tried to be as transparent as we can. You know, when we've had incidents that have involved the African-American community on a couple different occasions, and this is not just since I've been chief, this is before I was chief, so I'm not trying to take credit for work other people have done. But, you know, we've invited a group of African-American pastors in to say, hey, this was an incident that took place. Here's the video that we have of it. We want you to see it. Here's our policy on it. Here's what the officers did. Here's what the officers didn't do, so that they can then help us correctly message that in the community. Because again, me saying what the officers did is correct is going to be probably received with some hesitation by people in the African-American community, right? Especially if it was a situation with an arrestee being an African-American and an officer being white. So in those situations, we try and kind of put everything out there so our faith leaders can see that, and then they can help carry that message back into the community, because it's going to be much better received in those situations. So again, we're partnering with a lot of different folks in the community to try and do different programs, different things. You know, we're at the Boys and Girls Club a lot with badges for basketball, badges for baseball. Mm-hmm. We're in the city schools where we're, you know, reading to elementary school age students on a regular basis. But the other part of that we very honestly still struggle with is recruiting minorities as well as females. You know, we are not anywhere close in our department to representing our community in terms of race or gender. And, you know, my challenge, quite honestly, we take a lot of the same paths that I just talked about in building trust in the community with trying to recruit, right? Okay, you know somebody in the African-American community you think would be a good police officer. I want to know about it. You know, my challenge always when I talk to people like you and others is, you know, if I had folks like you and other folks that are engaged and involved in this community, if I had every one of you just bring me one strong candidate, any candidate, but especially folks where we struggle with minorities and gender with women, my job would be so much easier, right? You know what qualities people have that make them a good police officer. I think generally people know, right? We need people that are honest. We need people that are trustworthy, that have integrity, right? That when no one else is looking, they're going to do the right thing. People are going to be fair. People are going to respect folks regardless of their, you know, religious beliefs or ethnicity or anything like that. So we still struggle in that area, though, I'll be honest with you, you know, to try and bring in folks that reflect our community a little bit more. So we're constantly recruiting on a variety of different methods, whether it be through social media, whether it be through job fairs, visiting universities, visiting military fairs, things like that. But, you know, the best candidates we often get are folks that are from here and know the community, right? I'll tell you, one of my biggest challenges 20-some years ago when I moved here was not only, one, finding my way around, right? Because this is not the easiest city to find your way around in. But secondly, is learning the long history here of race relations in this community and how that impacts the community and how it impacts how we interact as a law enforcement agency. So the more people we can get as a part of the force that have a knowledge of that already and have lived through that and grown through that, do great. We have a young officer, a female officer by the name of Tarika Grooms. And Tarika is an exceptional young woman who has just got a knack for being able to talk to people. You know, the biggest tool, you know, you look at the duty belts of our officers and they look like Batman, right? They've got all these tools on, but the biggest tool our folks have is right here, right? It's their ability to talk and communicate. And she does an exceptional job of that. And she's able to make that connection with the African-American community, obviously, because she was born and raised in those types of communities. And she's just a really, really good young officer. She's an example of what we need more of in our police department, so we can better reflect the community. And she's just a great communicator and a heck of a recruiter too. I'll tell you what, she brings us a lot of good candidates to look through too. So that we need it on all fronts. Our best recruiters are our community that know those people that they think could do well for us.
Well, if you know someone and you're listening, or if you think you're the person, please reach out to the police department.
Absolutely.
I think you guys are the line between where we want to see our community go and where we don't want to see our community go. And so it's important that we have people that care about Lynchburg, that care about this local community, because I think that, you know, one of the big things, you know, again, I promote this podcast time and time again, is local, local, local. Like, we got to get our eyeballs off the national and really focus in on, like, how in this community am I going to touch lives?
Well, that's how we make a difference, right?
Exactly.
I mean, you came here from somewhere else. I came here from somewhere else.
Yeah.
In all brutal honesty, I had plans of staying here about 3 years and going somewhere else.
Who hasn't tried to leave
Lynchburg? I'm telling you, man. Lynchburg has a way of sucking you in. And when I say that in a good connotation. This community has so much to offer.
It's
vibrant. It's growing every day. We're doing a lot of really good stuff, not just in law enforcement, but economic development in this city is really taking off. I mean, the downtown area 20 years ago, it was a ghost town, and now it is very vibrant. There's a lot going on. And
y'all were working this place hard, Bobby, back then. Now it's like, you can just probably chill, go grab. I see police officers grabbing lunch and just relaxing. Like, man, look at downtown. I ain't got to go into a weird warehouse. I mean, there were so many rundown buildings. It's incredible. It's incredible to see the growth.
Which means
for you guys, again, to reiterate his point, means that we need more police officers.
Absolutely.
To help make sure that, you know, this place is safe.
You better believe it.
So as we, I want to respect your time, and I want to go into one more topic. And this is a big one for me that I'm reading on, learning about, and really being pushed with when I look at the future of community. So this last topic we're going to touch on is like communities in the future. All right. And so when we look at that, there's two different ways that we can see what you do as a profession. There's retributive justice, and then there's restorative justice. So I want to read two definitions, and then I'd like for you to tell me which one you believe is more aligned with your mission and vision, and why. Okay? So retributive justice, for those that don't know, is the theory of punishment that when an officer breaks the law, justice requires that he or she suffer in return. Offender.
I wonder where we were going with this one.
Wait a minute.
All right.
Let me read that one more time.
All right.
Retributive justice is a theory of punishment that when an offender breaks the law, justice requires that he or she suffer in return. It also requires that the response to a crime is proportional to the offense. Prevention of future crimes, deference, or rehabilitation of the offender are other purposes of punishment. Now, I want to read a little bit about restorative justice. So restorative justice repairs the harm caused by crime. When victims, offenders, and community members meet to decide how to do that, the results can be transformational. It emphasizes accountability, making amends, and if they are interested, facilitated meetings between victims, offenders, and other persons. So when you look at both of them comparatively, retributive justice is a perspective that focuses on punishment for offenders, while restorative justice focuses on the relationship between the offender and the victim. So, you know, Police Chief Zunima, for you, as you're looking to the future, I don't know how long you plan to be police chief, or as you train up, I mean, you are a leader in this community, so you're training up other officers and other community leaders. Which one would you say more aligns with your vision? restorative justice or retributive justice?
So I'll put a little caveat to this. I don't know. Based on the definitions you provided, I don't think it's quite as black and white as that. So, you know, I think it's sometimes it's specific. If I have to lean one way or the other, it's going to be somewhat dependent upon crime, quite honestly.
Okay.
It's also going to be dependent on a lot of other factors. So if you're asking me, do I think we need to rehabilitate people? Absolutely. We absolutely need to do that. The definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results, right?
Right.
So what we can't do is, let's say you have a drug problem, right? And we arrest you for possession of cocaine. And we lock you up. We give you no services. We give you no treatment. We give you nothing else. And we bring you back out. What are the chances when you get back out, you're going to go back to that way of life?
100%.
Yeah, probably pretty darn close, right?
Yeah.
So we've got to make sure we're taking and kind of wrapping services around you to figure out, are we really dealing with the problem or are we dealing with symptoms of the problem, right? Mm. So a lot of times we see, you know, methamphetamine is increasing the use of it in this area, unfortunately. And folks that get addicted to methamphetamine, they will break into and steal anything that is not bolted down to get something they can sell or trade to get money or just to get the methamphetamine. So, you know, is the problem there that they're a thief? No, the problem, okay, is that they're an addict. And we need to look at addressing that addiction. Now, you look at different crimes, okay, let's say murder, obviously to the far end of the spectrum, right? Does there need to be some type of retributive justice there? Yeah, I believe there does. Because the last thing we want is you to go kill someone and then just, okay, I'm going to sit down with the family and say, hey, I really didn't mean it. I was going through a real bad spot in my life. And you guys okay if I just hang out in the community for the rest of my life? Probably not, right? So we need to take into account the victim and or the victim's family as well as society, right? There are certain people, very bluntly, that they are very few, but there are certain people that we can't rehabilitate. There are some really bad people out in this community, not this one specific, but in society in general. Mm-hmm. We're lucky we live in a pretty safe community, but there are some people that need to be locked up because no matter what we do for them sometimes, they're going to always go back to that violent tendency. And these are the people that are real violent criminals. But you know, we absolutely need to be working more towards rehabilitating people, I think, in most cases, whenever we can, because incarcerating people costs a lot of money, a lot of money, right?
Yes.
And so why not better spend some of that money? Now, that doesn't mean you get a free pass when you commit a crime, right? There needs to be, I think, in a perfect world, a balance of some type of payment back to society, for lack of better terms, in a sense that, hey, you committed a crime and you've served whatever that time society feels is appropriate is, but also what steps, what measures, what programs are we putting in place to ensure the likelihood of you repeating that when you get out is minimal. And that's where I think we still struggle as a society, not just in Lynchburg, but across our nation is trying to find that balance. And it's a very difficult, and sometimes it's case specific, right? I mean, you've seen victims, family members of victims who have been killed, murdered, and their families like, look, put that person on the electric chair right now, and that should be the only way this should ever be resolved. And you see other families that are like, you know what, it's horrible, but I forgive him, and you know what, I want to see him be a productive member of society. So it can be very specific depending on, you know, the individual, the case, and things like that. But, you know, we definitely need to be providing better services. You know, we're involved in a lot of different things here in Lynchburg. We have a drug court here that's been going for about 2 years now. So if you're arrested...
Well, what is a drug court?
So a drug court is looking at offenders who are arrested for narcotics, not distribution, but for possession. Can't be tied to any type of violent crime. And there's certain parameters for you to be eligible for it. And it's a voluntary thing. So you might get a sentence, let's say you get charged and convicted, or charged rather than go to court for a possession of cocaine charge. You are given, if you meet the parameters of this program, an opportunity to go through a drug court, which means that you won't get convicted of this crime up front or tried on it. You'll have to go through a program that can last sometimes well over a year, and you're getting treatment, you're getting life skills, you're getting all these other things with the goal of correcting the addiction, if that's what it is,
that's awesome.
And helping show the person that you know, there's another way. We've graduated, I believe, 5 people out of that program already. We use really small numbers because that's how we're going to impact people, that one-on-one attention. You know, we're not going to impact people by throwing 200 people in a classroom and saying, okay, here's why you don't use drugs. We got to have that one-on-one attention, right? We got to have folks following up with them. Mm-hmm. Probation works with them a lot as a part of this program. And ultimately, if they successfully complete that program and graduate from that, they don't get that conviction on their record, mm-hmm. which is a big thing, right? A really big thing. But again, it's all voluntary. We don't force people to do it. They've got to be willing to do that themselves. And we provide a lot of the services to help them. And that's a partnership with a lot of different organizations here in the community. So a lot of times what we see is folks who have substance abuse issues, in many cases, sometimes have mental health issues too, right? Mm-hmm. They go hand in hand. And some of those folks are homeless on top of that, right? So mm-hmm. you compile all these things together, and locking them up in jail is not going to solve any one of those three things,
right?
We need to get them treatment. We need to get them services. And but we've got to balance that again with making sure that you know, that's just not a free pass, so to speak. So we work with that. We also work a lot with a CIT program, crisis intervention training. So that's for our officers to recognize when they're dealing with folks who are in crisis, right? Years ago when I started, you dealt with those people. If they commit a crime, you just lock them up. That was the end of it. Didn't matter what mental health problems they had, put them in jail. They committed a crime, done.
So not, way more restorative.
Right.
20 years ago, right.
Retributive.
Retributive, yeah. Yes, retributive.
Absolutely,
sorry.
Yeah.
So now, way more retributive 20 years ago, but absolutely. Now, what would you say would be the percentages now? If you were saying that you're, for the criminal justice system of Lynchburg City, would it be 70-30? Retributive?
Yeah, I'd have a hard time putting a number on it right now, okay. But I can just tell you over the last 2+ decades that I've been doing this job here in Lynchburg, that we are much more in tune with dealing with the core problem than dealing with the symptom, right? Again, that person that's breaking into a house to steal an iPhone or some type of, you know, electronic equipment to go pawn it so they can have $40 to go buy methamphetamine, right? Those are the folks we're trying to absolutely, initially, if there's a crime committed, we're going to arrest, but then we're going to try and get them services that they can help keep them from doing that again. We work a lot with Horizon Behavioral Health with a CIT program to recognize folks that are in mental health crisis and make sure we're getting them the treatment that they need as opposed to just, you know, locking them up. A lot of times these folks, again, that have mental health crisis, they may also have an alcohol addiction. And they're out drunk in public on the side of the street. Well, that's a crime. Technically, we could arrest them for drunk in public, take them down to the jail, throw them in there till they sober up. That didn't solve their problem because they get back out. Okay, they're sober now. The first thing they're going to do is they're still going to go find alcohol, and they're still going to have that mental health issue that they were dealing with before they got put into jail. So we're trying to divert those people when appropriate into mental health counseling and mental health treatment so that we can get them on the right path so that we're not, again, you know, we don't want to keep locking the same people up over and over again. That makes absolutely no sense. We want to get people the help they need, get them directed to the services they need so that they can be productive members of society.
Do you have a system in place right now? So if a kid, young kid from this community is reoccurring within these actions and you've seen this time and time again, like, okay, we got another young 14-year-old African-American male from this neighborhood selling weed, looks to be from, you know, single mother household or just, you know, rough side of town, we're going to put him into this program. Is there anything that bing, as soon as a child comes in with like, oh, young, these markers or whatever,
right,
these demos that tell you, oh, this is something we need to, you know, look for this, you know, restorative program that we have.
Right. So we use a concept here in Lynchburg, have for several years now, called intelligence-led policing. So that's looking at getting into data and analytics and looking at trends, especially to see exactly a lot of the things you're talking about. So if we see, you know, that over the last X number of months in this area of town, we've seen an increase in the number of teenage young men who are involved in narcotics distribution. That tells us we need to take some of our resources as a police department, better focus them on that area to determine what's there. And then from that, look at, okay, what other community partners do we need to get engaged with this? Because that's what we're all about, is trying to take as many resources as we can from the community and throw it at this problem. You know, I give an example. Years and years and years ago, we had a weed and seed grant back in the late 1990s.
A what?
It was called a weed and seed grant. So,
okay.
Federal program through Department of Justice. They provided lots of money for training and for overtime and for going out in the community. we went to an area where we'd had a lot of open air drug sales. Everybody knew it was an open air drug market. This is back in the late 90s where that was very prevalent. Now it's done by phone and a lot of other ways, but you could go up to a variety of street corners, literally just pull up and there'd be two or three guys waiting there to serve you crack cocaine. So we went in a couple of these areas with this. The idea was you would go in and you'd weed out the bad people or problem in that area, and then you would go in and put in programs afterwards to try and, you know, seed it, for lack of better terms. So if you asked any cop that worked that area for any amount of time, what's the biggest complaint neighbors have in that area? We just said, oh, drug dealing. Absolutely, without a question, drug dealing. Well, part of this program is we had to actually go door-to-door survey folks with, okay, tell us what your biggest complaints are. We went around. You want to know what the biggest complaint was in that neighborhood?
What was it?
It wasn't drug dealing. It was the fact that there was a vacant house. They had weeds grown up this tall, it was boarded up at one point, but people had broken into it and folks were going in there. There was prostitution going on there. They were worried about kids going in there and getting hurt in there. There were homeless people staying there, things like that. That was their biggest concern. So what we learned from that is we can't always assume we know what's going on in an area, and we've also got to gather other partners to come in and address it. So in that situation, we got, you know, city building inspections involved. We got a church that was in that area involved. We got folks to come in and volunteer to cut the grass down. We ultimately went to some of these houses. We tried to contact the property owners. They didn't want to cooperate to get this house fixed up. So we actually took in the city right away between sidewalks and the curb, which the city owns, and we erected signs that were, you know, this big by this tall. It says, if you don't like the appearance of this property or what's going on at this property, the owner's name is, his phone number is, and he lives at this address. And you know what? We found that that was a different way to address a problem that was causing a lot of other criminal-related activity. And the folks that lived in that area were tickled pink with that. That person didn't come and fix it, but he sold the property to someone who did come in and fix it. And so we've got to take this holistic approach to dealing with issues in our community, finding out what's the root cause of what's going on there, and not just assume we know because we've arrested 12 people at that intersection for dealing drugs.
I love that you asked the community, hey, what is your biggest issue going on in this community? And what you were like, all right, go ahead and tell me what I already know.
Right.
And they told you, not even close.
Exactly.
And I think that's powerful. I think that's what I would like to see the future continue to move into, is that we get better with analytics. We continue to define what are the best ways to reach out to these communities.
Right.
And then we begin to have police officers come from these communities and then better help, you know, facilitate a more healthy, you know, I guess, triangle of communication.
Absolutely.
You know, where the community is heard and what they feel they need the most help with, you're helping.
Right.
But then also you're doing your job and you're relaying from people from that community back to them, like, hey, at the end of the day, though, I can't allow someone to continue to sell crack cocaine.
Right.
And so it's a give and take of understanding where you're still meeting the community's needs, but also doing your job.
Well, it's an education piece too, right?
Yeah.
It's them understanding what we're doing, why we're doing it. You know, the why is so important, right? Especially nowadays, it is so important that people understand the why. If we take a little bit of time to explain the why, a lot of times their concerns are alleviated by just doing that, right? So a lot of times we assume, I think, as law enforcement, that people know why we do everything we do, and the majority of people don't. And we also got to recognize that although our officers interact, you know, we have about between 70 to 75,000 calls for service a year in the community here. So that's 70,000 interactions a Lynchburg police officer has with a community member. But what we sometimes fail to realize is that may be the only time that community member's interacted with a police officer in years. And they're going to remember every specific piece of information that was shared during that. And sometimes we kind of glaze over it just because it's onto the next call. So it's important to take the time, explain the why to them. And that helps, again, build those relationships and build that trust and legitimacy in our community.
Hmm. All right. Two more questions.
Okay.
Or three more. And then I'll let you go. I promise.
No, all right.
One, when you're looking at I think one of the things I remember when you were in Citizens Academy, you had talked about one of the big things is, you know, with the methamphetamines being picked up. I think I saw in the local news that you guys had a 40-person drug bust that was pretty big for methamphetamines here in the city. And as you look to the future, and I think you had addressed something about like a task force to really like hone in on the drug and crime problem. So as we had just talked about, you know, retributive versus restorative justice, and the task force, you know, what does that look like? Is that like more policing in these underprivileged areas? What is the goal of that? If that's what you're something that you're going to be doing. And do you think that, you know, more cops, more arrest is the way to address some of these issues in these communities, or for these communities that are just ravaged by the drug problem here in the city, or poverty, which is another big issue in the city?
Right.
Do you think that like more task force in that community is going to help? What are your thoughts on that?
So it's really a balance. You know, in a perfect world, all these things are interconnected, right? All the things you just mentioned, poverty and all these other things are so interconnected. You can't just isolate on one of them and say, okay, we're going to go fix poverty. Well, that's not going to happen without addressing all these other things that contribute to it. So, you know, I think in a community that, you know, has got a lot of challenges like that, I think we've got to tackle it from a balanced approach, right? You know, there's an enforcement piece and there's an engagement piece, right? So in a perfect world, we'd have additional officers that we could staff more in our community action team, or CAT. So that group goes around. They are not driven by calls for service. So they can go out into a community and work on a problem for 2 or 3 days straight without having to worry about getting pulled to go answer, you know, other calls. That's their role. So, you know, that group does really well because they're in the communities talking to the people, finding out what the problems are, like we talked about, seeing who the players are, building relationships, getting other resources tied into that community. Now, the other side of that, the enforcement side that we need to balance that with, we are in desperate need of additional officers to staff a full-time, what we call a CERT, which is a Special Investigations Response Team. We've put this group together every summer for the last several years, but it's a part-time thing. We literally draw officers from other assignments for about 3 months and task them with working on these specific things, which I'll talk about in a minute. But the problem is, while they're away doing that, the units that they came from are obviously, the workload doesn't stop for them, right?
Right.
So now those folks there are trying to pick up extra workload, and it's challenging already to do that even when they're fully staffed. So the CERT group would focus on basically guns, gangs, and drugs, right? They're going after our violent offenders, and usually those things are tied in together here. So, you know, those are the folks that we really need to get off our street, right? The folks that are out there committing violent crime. You know, we had in 2018, we had a really bad year in terms of number of homicides. Highest one we've had since I've been here as a police officer, we had 8. And so the challenge there, though, was 6 out of those 8 homicides in 2018 were either gun and or gang related homicides.
Okay.
So those are the people we're talking about, right? That CERT team would be going out there and trying to identify through intelligence led policing who those folks are, what they're involved in, and going out there and really addressing those problems. You know, it's the analogy is, you know, if you have a problem and you have an abdominal disease, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's spreading in your abdomen. I can go in there one of two ways to do it, right? I can go in there with a big hacksaw and just cut everything out and hope I got it, right? Or I can go in there with a scalpel and I can take out just the part that's infected.
Right.
That's what the CERT team does. They're the scalpel. They go in and they are going to target the violent folks that we have, right? There's not a lot of them, but their impact is big, right? You know, because they're involved. Again, a lot of times these gang members are involved in the drug trade. That's what it usually centers around. And how they kind of maintain their turf is through violent acts against each other in most cases. So having that balance of that enforcement and that engagement is, you know, I talked earlier about we're your partners and your protectors, right? We're your partners, so we're going to engage with you, and we're your protectors, so we're going to enforce, right? And I think having that balance in those communities is important, because the last thing we want is for a community to feel over-policed and underprotected. And if you think about that, that sounds like that's an oxymoron, right? But I will tell you, there are probably communities here that at some point in their history in Lynchburg have felt just that. They felt like they're over-policed and underprotected. So that's why we can't just go in there with an iron fist and just, you know, arrest everybody. We're never going to arrest our way out of our problems. We've got to go in there and build those relationships. And again, go in with that scalpel, so to speak, in that analogy, and pick out the really, really bad people, make sure that we're identifying them and charging them with the violent crimes that they're committing, and then coming in behind that, right, and continue to build those relationships there, because most of those communities don't want those people in there either, right?
Okay.
It's not like these communities are like, oh, well, you know, yeah, he grew up here, so it's okay that he's going around and shooting people and stabbing people and selling drugs. That's fine. No, right. They don't want those people there, right? But a lot of times, you know, because of concerns for their own safety, they're not as eager or willing to come forward, right? So we've got to figure out ways to engage them in a manner and a method that doesn't jeopardize their safety, but also still allows us to do our job.
When you're looking at the CERT team, is their goal as they are arresting and putting these specific people, because you're not saying the whole, so say a gang has, you know, one leader, maybe some, you know, different departmental leaders. So as you say, let's say eight guys are doing that, and there's like 50 to 75 other guys. So are the 50 to 75 other guys your restorative idea of like, we got to help these guys see there's another way? And then the eight guys, you're like, these guys need some time in prison. And that, so is that your way of like saying, you know, for the people that are going to be listening to this and being like, nah, man, if you're going to be restorative, be 100% restorative. Right. And for those listening, they're like, what is this guy saying? Restorative? This sounds weak. You need to be 100% retributive.
Right.
You know, so as you try, as you know, police chief, you're it's a hard road to navigate.
Absolutely.
When you're saying, hey, we're going to be more aggressively attacking this one issue.
Right.
And as we hire more staff, this is one of the vocal points, which means we're going to arrest more of these kind of people in these communities. That community, that those brings those tensions.
Right.
That's still someone's dad. That's still someone's friend. That's still someone's homie.
Right.
So what's the goal there?
Yes. Yeah, so I think the goal again is to try and, in a perfect world, if I got a full-time CERT team that I could staff with additional officers, the other side of that is we would staff our community action team with additional officers too, so they could focus on, because yeah, I mean, if you are able to go in and identify some of the leadership of an organization like a gang that is responsible for violent crime, I mean, you look down the road just a little ways in Danville, right? So they worked not too long ago with some federal partners there, mm-hmm. And they went in and levied some pretty heavy federal charges against these gang members, right? But, you know, when you look at the number of gang members, I don't know what Danville has in terms of numbers, but I would probably argue to you that it was a very small percentage, right? So we're looking at the most violent offenders to try and get them out. And then, to your point, the others that aren't necessarily the real hardcore gang members, they're more what we would call an associate or an affiliate gang member. Yeah, they hang out with them. They've probably grown up with them, but they're not out there committing the robberies. They're not out there doing the shootings or things like that. Those are the folks that absolutely we want to show them, like, look, here's another path, right? Here's another path you can take, because if you continue on the path, you're going to end up like you saw over here, right? Mm. You know, there's nothing more that hurts me than when I see a young man who's 15, 14, 16 years old who commits a violent crime that puts him away for the rest of his life, right? You know, our goal is to try and engage these folks at a much younger age. I mean, I'll be brutally honest with you. By the time they're 14, it's too late in many cases. We got to be engaging these folks in elementary school, in the middle schools, and helping them understand that there's another path there. You know, a lot of these young men are unfortunately don't have great role models in their lives, right? So we've got to do something, whether it's us or connecting them with somebody who can be, so they can see there's a path other than you know, a path of crime. I remember a young man many years ago that I was dealing with in a city school, and he was in some trouble in school, and I was just talking to him. I was there helping out the school or something, and sat down and I asked him, I said, you know, what do you want to be when you get older? And he looked me dead in the eye. He was 14 or 15 years old, I think, at the time, and he said, I want to be a thug, is what he told me. And it was just a foreign concept to me, right? Like, that was, he had no aspirations, right? Because no one had probably ever told him, hey, you can go to college. Hey, you can be this. Hey, you can be that. Hey, you can do this, right? So we've got to find ways to engage our youth at a much, much younger age. You know, a lot of the organizations I've been involved with over the years on boards and that have been youth-focused organizations, because I truly believe that's where we're going to make the most difference. By the time they're in their mid to late teens, you know, they're oftentimes on a path. I'm not saying we can't help them, but we need to keep them from being in a place where they need help at that age, right? And don't even let them get down that path. So absolutely, we need to come in behind and show these young men and women there's other opportunities out there.
That's good. That's good. All right, last two questions. If you could be God and create the perfect community, would there be police men and women? If so, why? And if not, why?
That's a tough question. If I could create the perfect community, would there be? I think a perfect community or a utopia assumes that everybody would always follow the rules, right? Mm-hmm. And I think human nature, without getting to too biblical on it, you only have to look at the first chapter to realize that somebody wasn't listening to what they should have been doing, right?
All right, so like in the question, in this kind of question, I thought about it too. I was like, he's probably going to say, there's going to be somebody that's like, nah, and then it just all goes downhill.
I mean, the challenge is, right, that overwhelmingly, especially in Lynchburg, we have an overwhelmingly supportive community here for law enforcement. We have overwhelmingly a community that I think really has the best interests of each other at heart. I mean, this community has got more groups and nonprofits that look out and get engaged and involved, which is can sometimes be a double-edged sword because sometimes we're duplicating efforts a little bit, right? I think, you know, the very small portion of the community that we deal with, I think in any society you're always going to have some, and there needs to be folks there who are there to protect those that are could be oppressed or the weak that aren't able to protect themselves. And, you know, I'm proud of the work our men and women do each and every day. You know, they go out there and put themselves in harm's way to make sure that, you know, your mother, your grandmother, your sister, your aunt, your uncle, whoever it may be, can go to bed hopefully at night without thinking too much about, you know, harm coming their way. And that's because our folks are out there making a lot of sacrifices to make sure that happens. So I would say you'd probably always need some type of a police force. And we've had one here in Lynchburg since 1805, so well over 200 years. And it's looked a lot differently, I'm sure, over the years, obviously, as it does now. But, yeah, I think there's always going to be somewhat of a role for law enforcement.
So I'm doing a ride-along
all right,
pretty soon, and I am nervous. And I've watched too many things, and I'm just like, I was like, man, how do I prepare myself? And then I'm like, wait a minute. I got the police chief on a podcast. So I thought, who better to ask than you to help give me some tips on how to survive? Because I'm going to be honest, you know, police chief's going to be like, you know, I do a little, you know, Muay Thai, Jiu-Jitsu, but I'm not trying to like get too much into the action. You know, I think you guys do a great job, and I want to be as far away whenever anything goes down. But I do want to like see what it's like to be in that day to day. So like, what are some tips and tricks? Like, how should I approach, you know, a ride along? Cause like, you know, I just keep thinking of like, you could end up like Kevin Hart where it's hilarious. And I'm just like, you know, with a buff drug dealer, like, hey man, I don't know, man. I'm just like, I'm just here. Like I'm with him. I don't know what's going on.
Right.
Or it could be like something like really, really, really chill, and we just like drive around and see the city, and like, you know, nothing happens.
So I think the best way, first and foremost, is to approach it with an open mind. You know, a former police chief here in Lynchburg that hired me, actually, Chuck Bennett, I used to tell folks, and I think it's still valid today, that, you know, Lynchburg looks a lot different through the windshield of a police car. You know, you're going to see maybe even areas you've seen before, and you will see how people will interact very differently with you just because you're in a police car. They won't know you're a ride along probably at first. They may think you're part of the force. They may not know, but you'll see how people interact with you probably a little bit differently because you are associated with the police department, good or bad, maybe. But you know, keep an open mind. The officers, first and foremost, are not going to let you get in harm's way. Part of their responsibility is to do everything they can to keep you safe, obviously. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the officers will let you know when it's safe to go somewhere or not safe to go somewhere. They may say, stay in the car for this one, or they may say, come along
with me.
Give
me a baton?
I don't think we're going to give you a baton.
So all I got is my hands to protect myself.
Yeah, you're going to have to fall back on your martial arts training, I think. But
rear naked choke anyone I see.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. But I hope it's a good experience for you. I would encourage any of your listeners to do that. They can go on our website and download a form to fill out to do that. And it gives you, I think, a little bit better appreciation of what goes on in the community here. And, you know, just by the nature of, again, human nature, there's probably parts of the community that all different walks of life have never been to, don't realize exist here in Lynchburg. And it's a very diverse community. It really is. And, you know, it's a good opportunity to see what goes on at night and what doesn't. And hopefully you'll have a good time and be able to see some of the great work our men and women do each and every day here.
Man. Thank you so much, Police Chief Zunima.
Absolutely.
This has been a pleasure. I have like just soaked in a lot of the knowledge, and I think this is just important. I hope we can continue to do this.
Absolutely.
I hope that you continue to be a part of this community. Don't shave your mustache.
Oh,
don't let.
Sorry.
Listen,
unless you want me living in your basement come Saturday, I think my better half is ready for that thing to come off. Yes. Yeah, so I appreciate your support, but it's coming off after Friday, I think. So you got it.
Oh, man. Sojourners, thank you all so much for listening. Guys, please like, share. You don't have social media, do you?
We have it at the department. I don't have it personally.
Follow the police academy,
Lynchburg Police Department. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. So, we were very, very lucky this past year in May to hire our first ever community relations coordinator who serves as our public information officer and does a great job with our social media.
And that person, do you like them in that role? Do you feel like they do a good job?
Yeah, she does a great job, and she's been a great addition to our team. And
that's awesome.
We'll continue to push us forward into the next century. So,
man, I'm proud of you for getting someone to handle that social media.
Absolutely.
I want to see for the person, whoever that she is, I'd love to see some behind the scenes on this ride along. Actually, they could follow and film with me.
That could be interesting.
Episode where we could just do a partnership.
Let's talk about it.
You know what I'm saying?
Right,
just
we'll
like give a little behind the scenes look into like how a citizen enjoys a ride along and the things that we see.
We'll see what we can do with that.
Man, thank you so much, guys. Follow the police department. Thank y'all for just listening to this. And remember, guys, when you're thinking about anything the news tells you, there's their side, there's the other person's side or the other issue side or whatever other side, and then there's the truth right in the middle. And so I think from everything that I've seen in my life, it's important to learn about the other aspect of something that you're being told and to not just take everything as 100%. So this has been really good for me to just like better understand the other side of the police department. So
absolutely.
It's really cool.
Been a pleasure. Thank you.
Have a good night.
All right. You too.